journey in the spiritual life is really one of recognizing that the reign of God is here and now. And how are we living that out? And how am I, as an instrument of God's love, living that out today?
Vanessa White is Associate Professor of Spirituality and Ministry and Director of the Certificate in Black Theology and Ministry at Catholic Theological Union in Chicago. She holds a dual appointment in Xavier University of Louisiana's Institute for Black Catholic Studies. She belongs to several academic societies, among them the National Black Storyteller Association, the American Academy of Religion, and the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality, which is where I met her. We speak today about her work as an activist and theologian, and how spiritual life bridges social and religious identities and offers healing in a time of intense division. I'm Matthew Wickman of BYU's Faith and Imagination Institute. Vanessa, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's great to see you too, Matthew.
So I forget exactly when it was we met, only that I was at one of the many conferences that we've attended together as members of the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality. What I do know is that I've wanted to talk with you on the podcast for a long time. So thank you so much for taking the time to come on here.
It's good. It's good to be with you today. I hope that I will be able to share some of my experience and also some of my passion in the field of spirituality with you today.
Thank you. Yeah, I if you don't, it's my fault. Okay, so I'll try not to mess this up.
All right.
Now, your work brings together theology and race. So I want to ask you also about a third topic that you add to that equation, and that's the topic of spirituality. And I'm wondering, how'd you wind up in that subfield of theology? How'd you come to the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality? And just as much, why have you stayed with it?
All right. Well, when I was deciding where I was going to land, I had a passion. I've always had a passion about spirituality. I've always had a passion around faith. For me, it is just as natural as breathing for me to be engaged in all of this. And I actually decided to pursue a doctorate in spirituality because of my bishop. I was asking my bishop in my diocese, what should I study? And he said, well, we've got historians, we've got systematic theologians, we've got people in liturgy, but we really don't have within the Black community at this time, people who have studied spirituality. And I was like, oh, all right. Well, this is something I have passion around. So that's how I got involved in spirituality. I was always pushing. I was director of a lay volunteer program at one point. And one of their tenets was the fact that they were apostolic, was about community service and spirituality. And I was always pushing them, even when I was a volunteer in their program, where's the spirituality? I don't see us being attentive to the spirituality. So it all seemed to make sense. Okay, yes, I'll go into spirituality. And I've enjoyed it. I've been in spirituality as studying it. I've been a professor of spirituality, I would say almost 15, moving toward the 20-year mark. So
okay.
I'm very passionate about this.
Yeah, no, which I appreciate. Now, spiritual life, it's a core aspect of what it means to be human. For Christians, what it means to be a child of God. But the academic study of spirituality is a disciplinary field. And so here's a question I have. Have you found there to be a significant overlap between spirituality as a phenomenon, a life-giving principle, right, and spirituality as a field? Or have those things come to seem somewhat separate and distinct to you?
Well, I'll have to say there's two parts to that question. What I experienced when I first came to the very first Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality, and how I have journeyed as a professor in spirituality. So I came to the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality, and I just assumed that when we'd have meetings, there'd be prayer. And there wouldn't be. Okay. Of all the groups that I thought would begin a gathering in prayer, I would think that the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality would begin with prayer. So for me, there was somewhat of a disconnect with that. Now, let me contrast that with the fact that I'm also a member of the Black Catholic Theological Symposium, which is an association of Black Catholic theologians and scholars who are focused on Black theology, ministry, and culture. Whenever we begin a meeting, no matter what it is, we always begin with prayer. So this had been my experience in a theological association, and then I came to the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality, and I wasn't experiencing that. So for me, yes, there was a disconnect. Now, let me move that to being a professor of spirituality. I'm a professor of spirituality who primarily is focused on the praxis of spirituality, how we live that out. So for me, the classroom is an environment where students can have that experience of conversion and transformation. And so in the classroom, we always begin with prayer. The students learn to engage in prayer. The students also are engaged in the spiritual practices as they journey through the semester in the course, because these spiritual practices will help them when they graduate and get out in the world and are advocates in justice, in peace, or parish ministers, or a variety of different aspects. So for me, there is not this disconnect. There is not this either or. It's a both and.
Okay, all right, that's good. At BYU, where I teach, it's a religious university. So that's what you and I have in common. We work at different universities, but both are places of religious institutions. And we have classes I teach begin with prayer, which I did not do when I got here. This has been something I've adopted over the years, because I found that it actually creates for a richer learning environment. I think when the spirit's present, the mind opens in ways otherwise it might not be, and we make connections we don't otherwise make between things.
Or even having students when they walk into the classroom, let's just take a moment of silence.
Yeah, good.
Whether you want to call it a prayer, now let's take a moment of silence, because they're rushing in from all different places, and then they're expected to be able to listen to you. Let's take a moment and
Yeah.
stop.
Yeah.
And I've seen the difference in just doing that.
There is a difference. Yeah, I agree with that. But of course, it's not always easy to bring kind of the practice of spirituality into academic areas, terrains, because it's almost like it's drawing on different facets of our experience, different parts of the brain almost sometimes, it seems.
That's true. That's
Yeah.
true.
Let me ask you about this piece that you published with CNN.com back in 2010. Now, I've done a lot of writing, but never CNN.com. So this is kind of a high-profile piece that you did. And the title is really provocative. It's Authentically Black and Truly Catholic. Now, I love that title. Although, as you point out in the article, the two things that you bring together there, black and Catholic, have not always held together easily. I want to ask you about this. First, you mentioned in the article you weren't born Catholic. Can you tell us then how you came to be well, really, it's how Catholicism can be a central part of your identity.
Well, even that term, I wrote that I think over 15 years ago. I wrote it quite a
Yeah.
while ago.
2010, yeah.
So since then, I've reflected more on what it means. I'm saying that I wasn't born Catholic. Now, I was baptized at an early age.
Okay.
I was really baptized at an early age. So I went to Catholic grade school. And even as a child, I had dreams of a symbolic nature that when I reflect today, I'd have dreams of Jesus dying on a table. Well, when I reflect on that today, that could be the holy sacrifice of the Mass. Those could have been, but my little brain could not understand that. So there's always been that sense that I've been Catholic almost all my life. If I think now how old I am, I'm 68 years old. I became Catholic when I was 8 or 9. So I've been Catholic just about my whole memory has been as Catholic. And I think of Catholic, being Catholic like a coat, that there's all these beautiful coats out there. But the coat, and they're all great coats, but the Catholic coat fits me best.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that other coats aren't great coats and whatever, but somehow that coat doesn't fit me as well as these other coats. So that's how I inhabit being Catholic, that being Catholic just fits me and who I am and how I move and the lens that I look through.
Okay. That code of knowledge makes a lot of sense. I think that's a great way to describe it. Leads me to this question here. You talk in the article about the great American sociologist and historian W.B. Du Bois, right? And his notion of double consciousness, which refers to the difference between how we perceive ourselves and how we're perceived by other people.
Yes.
And you write this in your article. I'm going to quote you here. You write, "Today, a particular form of double consciousness is experienced by Black Catholics as a religious minority within a broader Black church community who defend our religious affiliation to our Black Protestant brothers and sisters, while also confronting discrimination and ignorance from those within our own Catholic churches." Okay, yes. So I've got two questions here. First, is there one of these groups, either the Black church community and the Catholic community, that's been more difficult for you to negotiate? That's the first question. And the second one is this. Given that we're nearly 15 years on from when you wrote that piece, has the ground shifted? Has the nature of that double consciousness changed during that time?
All right. I'll first answer the double consciousness question first. And I'll answer that question with just thinking, what the movie that won Best Screenplay at the Oscars was American Fiction. American Fiction is about a Black writer who is seen through the lens of the white institution of publishers that he had to act a particular way to be Black. Hmm. Now, this movie is 2023-2024, and it's still true. That movie was very true, you know, spoken. So in many ways, things have not changed. There's still that double consciousness and how we see ourselves and how the institution, the institution sees us, predominantly white institution sees us as very different, and how we have to act. And it can become, in many ways, it can become very tiring. Particularly, it's a daily struggle. It wears on our psyche and our spirit. And that's where spirituality is very important. Being attentive to spiritual practices, being attentive to prayer, being attentive to self-care, storytelling, doing all those things that help us to navigate through double consciousness and what happens. Now, let me move to looking at Catholics and predominantly institution in the United States, which is a white institution, and the Black church in the United States, because that's what I primarily speak about. Yes, I would say there is still that sense of double consciousness going on, particularly within the Catholic realm. And within my dealings and relationships with my brothers and sisters who are Black from other religious denominations, I don't see so much of attention or this sense of stereotyping. It's primarily, if we love Jesus, we love Jesus no matter what denomination we are part of. We love God no matter what denomination we are. So that is the primary importance, the relationship. So relationship is important.
Yeah.
In regard to that. Within the Catholic realm, I still have to prove that I'm Catholic enough. There are still even students who are surprised that I know about Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross. You know, I didn't realize, you know, one, I'm Catholic, and two, I'm a professor of spirituality. And yes, I would know that. Why would I be teaching here? But still that sense of having to prove yourself, because you're not really Catholic. This still is very surface. So there's still that goes on that I have to journey with on a regular basis. I won't say a daily basis, but on a regular basis.
Yeah, okay. That makes a lot of sense, you know, and you certainly are plenty qualified to talk about the things you do at your university, at the Catholic Theology Union. Let me ask you this. You've written about the unease, or as you write it, like this, the dis-ease, D-I-S-ease, mm-hmm. That many white Catholics, and really more generally, it's many white Christians, many whites in general, okay, have talking about race. It's not easy mm-hmm. for whites to talk about race. You write that in the article there, the CNN piece. Has that changed, in your view, in any way in the last 15 years? Do you find that it's either easier or is it more difficult today to have those kinds of discussions?
With some people, it's easier. With others, it's not. many times, even those persons who you, who may be doing the racial, maybe doing the justice work or doing work, they see themselves whites, and I'm predominantly speaking about white, my white colleagues who are doing the justice work or are writing about these topics. They may think because they write about these topics, they know about these types. They don't have any racism, or they don't have, they're not racist themselves. And so if I bring up topics or if I say something, I still will be, get a clap down. You know, I had a situation not long ago with a colleague that we were working together, and that person, I could tell from the, even from the beginning, that they did not think that I was scholarly enough, put quotations around that. And then when I quoted books from their own discipline that they didn't know about, then it was like, oh, I guess you have done your study. But when I challenged them on a particular point where they had really made an assumption about another colleague who was Black, they jumped on me. It was very startling. And I could, and how dare I, and all the work that they've been doing. And so there is still that sense of what I say, which the whole book has been written about it, about white fragility.
Yeah.
So I think white fragility is still evident. And even looking at racism is something that white people are really going to have to work on and make some changes in this institution in the United States. It's not going to be, you can't put it on Black people to make the changes. They have to, these institutions that are primarily white run needs to have a conversion of heart and mind and action by white people. And they are going to have to admit that by virtue of living in the United States of America, they have absorbed some of those stereotypes, some of those beliefs, some of those assumptions. And there has to be an unlearning of that which they have learned.
And that process there is long, right?
Yes.
And it's arduous. Mm-hmm. There's a story. This is not about race, but it's a topic also that will be familiar to you as a female scholar. It surprised me. About 10 years ago, I was at a major university giving, I was part of a symposium out there, and there were several scholars there who were very distinguished scholars. You know, I was kind of in the presence of some very well-known people, and got talking at dinner with a couple of established female scholars of literature, and they started telling stories about some chauvinistic sort of run-ins they'd had with people. And I asked him, I said, so, you know, is it better now than it was back when you were first, you know, in the profession? And I was surprised what they said. They said, it's gotten so much worse. And I thought, what? Because I was a bit younger, and I you know, come of age at a time when, you know, feminism was regularly taught, the same way that race is regularly taught in universities. Mm-hmm. But they said, as more women have entered the profession, it's posed a threat to men, such that they found that the kinds of comments they'd hear and the kinds of practices they'd see were getting more shrill and mm-hmm. bolder. And this puts to, and I felt, I guess that makes sense. It was surprising, though. It's like, I thought we'd made progress, and they were saying maybe not so much. You know, these days there's so much, we're more racially conscious as a nation.
That's true.
But for that reason, we might also be more racially vicious.
That's probably true too. I like to use, there's all those little microaggressions.
Yeah.
The things I've done daily, they're like, as I said, they're like mosquito bites, and you keep getting bit, you know, and it's just the swelling gets bigger and bigger, and you're trying to slap this one off, this mosquito off, and another one comes there and bites you.
Yeah.
And so there's all of that going on. At the same time, you know, in saying that, there are, I do also see that among the younger a younger generation of scholars, they are trying to do the work. They are really trying to learn and do the work, and really seeing that we need to change institutions, and we need to be aware of the power that each one of us has in our particular context. We each have power. I am a Black Catholic professor at a school of theology and ministry. I could lament on racism and what has been done to me and all the microaggressions and the challenges. But I also have to admit that I have some power. I have power in the sense of being able to develop classes and the ability to be sitting on committees to say some things and to speak truth to power.
Yeah.
And so focusing on that hope, because what you focus on is what you give power to. So focusing on that hope, focusing on those places where I can make change, where things can happen, helps sustain me in the work of racial justice, particularly within a school of theology and ministry.
Okay, good. You mentioned one form of that power is the ability to teach classes. Leads me to this sort of question here. So there's an article you published recently called We Shall All Be Free, Theological Education and the Journey Towards Racial Justice and Freedom. And you talk about how the murder of George Floyd in 2020, which is such a flashpoint for the nation, had an impact also on the work that you do at Catholic Theological Union. And it led to the development of a new course. So can you tell us what course that is?
Okay. I want to say, just to step back, it was in the wake of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, because I'd like to mention about Breonna Taylor.
Good.
Because they both died during that summer and by police. And though the world really galvanized around George Floyd, I don't want to leave out this woman who was also, whose death was evident.
Yeah.
I recently read the book by Isabel Wilkinson, Caste, Origins of Our Discontent. And I began thinking on a walk, because I do a lot of my thinking on walks, about developing a course that would put her book in conversation and in dialogue with Brian Massengill's book entitled Racial Justice in the Catholic Church. And so that the following summer, I taught this course. 1 week, and I had 40 students and they all, at the end of the class, they encouraged me, this course needs to be taught over a semester, not just for 1 week.
Yeah, for sure.
So what happened, not long after that, first I was, Santa Clara University reached out to me about teaching this course, and I said, oh, this would be good for me to check it out, try this out. So I taught the course for a quarter at Santa Clara, and students were very encouraged. It was very transformative for them. And so then the following semester, I've taught it at CTU. And so it's become part of the regular semester courses at CTU. Now, one of the books that we used, which was a source book, was The Spiritual Works of Racial Justice by Patrick St-Jean.
I love that. I love him. He's great.
I love that book. As a spiritual practice book, because and when you engage in this work, when you begin to peel off the veil that students had over their eyes, the blinders, about what is taking place and what has taken place, and how they, in many ways, have been complicit in this racism and casteism that's in our country, you need to be engaged and attentive to the spirit. It's only being connected with the spirit that can help sustain you through these times. And so since the time of developing that course, I have also developed some other courses. I have a course that I've developed entitled Anti-Blackness and White Supremacy, Soul Sickness and Moral Choice, that I teach with a moral theologian, one of the ethics professors here. This coming April, I'm taking a group of students down to Alabama for a racial justice pilgrimage to Alabama. So we will go to Birmingham, Selma, and Montgomery and see the birthplace of the civil rights movement in these areas. Because students, many of our students, they hear these words, but they don't really know. And I find with many younger students, getting them engaged in hands-on is a good way to help them learn and to transform. So besides that, I also teach Black spirituality and I teach the spiritual writings of Thea Bowman and Howard Thurman. So those courses have been birthed in many ways out of my own raised consciousness about being a Black Catholic theologian.
Okay. I'm so glad you mentioned Patrick Saint-Jean. He's a former guest in this podcast. He's become a friend of mine. He's a dear soul and a very prolific writer and so insightful. I love Patrick.
So very.
You know, and just so warm and generous too. He's not somebody, I mean, there's a warmth to him. It's very inviting, but also very convicting. I've Patrick's writing.
We haven't met personally, but we have met through emails. So yeah. We've kept touch emails, and so I have found them very welcoming.
Yeah, for sure. Let me ask you about this part. You mentioned teaching it by way of spirituality. Do you think these things by way of spirituality? Do you see, so you must see spirituality as a bond of healing across racial divides. Do you ever find though that the opposite can happen, that spirituality can obscure divisions that need to be addressed in more concrete ways, whether socially or politically? Do you find that spirituality is an excuse not to do the work ever for some people?
Well, I teach a course at CTU entitled Spirituality and Justice, and it's an introductory course at the school where I teach. And so it's taught the first year of their theological studies. And I would have students in the classroom that had never thought about that there's a connection between spirituality and justice. They didn't see a connection at all, which let me know, yes, this course needs to be an introductory class, because for many, the sense of spirituality is me and God. You know, it's just me and God, and that's it. And maybe I treat my neighbor nicely, but not thinking how spirituality and the journey in spirituality and justice is about right relationships. Spirituality is about entering into relationship. The greatest commandment is about love God, self, and others. And how are you being loving? How is this institution being loving? How are we journeying in love? If there are people who do not have food, if there are people who do not have a place to stay, if there are people who do not have health care, if there are people who have been turned away just for the color of their skin, or have been abused and attacked in any way because of their gender. So you cannot separate spirituality from action. Out of spirituality comes action.
Okay. Amen to that. Yes. Agreed. Entirely. And bravo you for the ways that you make that very clear, explicit for your students and those with whom you're in your writing as well. I've got time for a couple more questions to ask you. And I'm thinking about this interesting life that you've led. You know, go back in time, you know, kind of imagine yourself kind of the age of a lot of your students. You're 20 years old, you know, thereabouts. Would your 20-year-old self be surprised at the life you've built as a teacher in theology and ministry? And would this have been a life your younger self would have wanted? Or would you have been horrified at the thought that one day you'd be teaching these things, you know, to college students?
Well, let me say right off the bat that as a 20-year-old, I was very introverted. I'm still introverted. I say I'm a social introvert now, but I was very introverted. You could not get me to talk in front of a group of people. That was not happening. I was very insecure in my own skin. If you had told me that I would be doing this, I would have said, oh, yes, right. I would not have believed you in the first place. Also, I had all these sheroes, you know, such as Sister Thea Bowman. You know, I learned about her and just her way of being. And at that time, even my own sense of being a Black Catholic was very much guitar mass, was not bringing, you know, myself as a Black person into the mass or into this spirituality. So there was this disconnect, you know, how that this is Catholic and this is not. So very much that. So, but the journey in spirituality is a journey in freedom. As you move closer in union to God, it allows you to become free. And allows you to become your authentic self in God. And so that is the spiritual journey of moving to freedom. And so as I journeyed in the spiritual life, as I began, I worked at a hospital for a number of years with children. And then I had this epiphany. I had this bad car accident. I should have been dead. The money I used from the car accident, I went to the Holy Land. And it was in the Holy Land I had this epiphany, came back restless. And from that journey of restlessness, it's led me to this day. The Spirit moved that restlessness. And so that Spirit moved me also into becoming my true self, my true self.
Okay.
And so I can't speak anymore. You know, that's it. So yes, I'm surprised that I moved from here or there, but it was the journey of living in the Spirit.
Okay.
This place.
All right. Then let me ask you one last question. This one, looking forward to the future, right? So you think about the issues that motivate your scholarship and your teaching and your ministry. If you could sort of devise the ideal fusion of those things, you know, what you'd love to be doing with those in 5 or 10 years, is this the kind of work you think you'll actually be able to do? Or do you suspect that the kind of the problems and injustices that we face will drive you to take up other subjects? In other words, I guess I'm asking about, you know, what's the world that you want to live in, and what's the world you actually expect to find as you look forward?
Well, as I alluded to earlier, I am moving, my age is at a particular place that I am moving at some point to what am I thinking about doing next. I, at the same time of saying that, I really don't think too much about what's going to happen in the future, because in thinking about the future, I'm missing what's happening in the present. And the journey, to me, the journey in the spiritual life is really one of recognizing that the reign of God is here and now, and how are we living that out? And how am I, as an instrument of God's love, living that out today?
Well, you know, in my observation, and I don't know you all that well, but from what I can see, you're doing an awfully fine job of that, Vanessa.
Thank you.
And it is a real pleasure to talk with you on the podcast. Thank you for your really important work and for sharing your journey with me and with our listeners. Much appreciated.
Well, thank you, Matthew, for reaching out to me. It's been a joy just having this conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Sophia Snyder and Starley Pratt. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.